I'm Allison Thompson, and you're listening to Radio for Peace International. Today we're going to talk about mycorrhizae. If you don't know what mycorrhizae is, then stay tuned.
What are mycorrhizae? Mycorrhizae are a symbiotic relationship between fungi and plant roots. The term literally means fungus root. Perhaps more than 75% of species of higher plants have these relationships. And so do many ferns, and some mosses, especially liverworts. They are common on crop plants, cereals, peas, tomatoes, onions, apples, strawberries, etc. As in wild plant communities, and in several cases, they have been shown to be important and even essential for plant performance. As the American plant pathologist Stephen Wellum said, in agricultural field conditions, plants do not, strictly speaking, have roots. They have mycorrhizae. So why is it that such a beneficial organism would be such an unknown in the world? We're going to start by asking people just like you, what is mycorrhizae? We're asking today, what is mycorrhizae?
Bunch of little rhizes.
Mycorrhizae communicating with each other and sending information and carbon and water and regulating everything. It's just like walking into an alien world.
Mycorrhizae or mycorrhizing?
Mycorrhizae.
Mycorrhizae. It's something close to minimizing, so I guess.
Okay. 4 miles of mycorrhizae filament. And mixed in that teaspoon are probably 10,000 different organisms, microbes, little things, and soil.
I guess it's some miniaturized recording device.
And it directly communicates in an embracing way with the vegetable kingdom, and then turns around and talks to mammals to spread itself. If this isn't intelligence, what is? We're not talking to nobody else but ourselves.
Mycorrhizae, it sounds like something you'd put in your computer.
What are mycorrhizae?
More than 90% of plant species form a symbiotic arrangement with beneficial soil fungi called mycorrhizal fungi. The roots are colonized by the soil fungus, which attaches to the roots and extends far into the surrounding soil environment. The colonized root is called a mycorrhiza. Mycorrhizal fungi are the dominant microbes in undisturbed soils, accounting for 60% to 80% of the microbial biomass. The loss of mycorrhizae diversity is a global environmental emergency. The Pacific Northwest of the United States, thanks to a prevailing onshore breeze preventing the buildup of acid rain, still has over 500 types of mycorrhizae. Europe has less than 10. Today we're talking to two men who have dedicated their lives to the replacement of this near-lost underground natural resource.
Today we're going to be talking to David Arthur, mycorrhizae field researcher.
We want a humble day on planet Earth, where we revere the Earth.
And Dr. Mike Amaranthus, who spent 20 years with Oregon State University and the U.S. Department of Agriculture Forest Service. He wrote more than 50 research papers on mycorrhizae. He is the recipient of the USDA highest honors for scientific achievement. He is president and chief scientist for Mycorrhizal Applications Incorporated.
You don't need to irrigate, and that's why these natural areas survive and even thrive without inputs of water, fertilizer, and pesticides.
David Arthur, welcome to the program. Let's talk about a teaspoon of soil and what might be in it.
4 miles of mycorrhizae filament. And mixed in that teaspoon are probably 10,000 different organisms, microbes, little things, and soil. And what this does, the microbes and the mycorrhizae create a sponge-like apparatus below the soil so that the soil is able to take water through the roots and pass through it. It forms what they call a rhizosphere. Rhizo meaning root and sphere meaning sphere. It's a root zone that extends under all healthy forest trees. It's probably 20 feet across, 6 feet deep. And each teaspoon has 4 miles in it. So you can imagine the trillions of miles beneath each tree. And these trees are all interconnected with other trees, and it goes all the way across the Pacific Northwest in one even though there are different species of mycorrhizae, it is totally continuous all the way up into British Columbia from Northern California. It's a huge organism. It acts like a big computer, a fungal computer. 535 kinds of mycorrhizae communicating with each other and sending information and carbon and water and regulating everything. It's just like walking into an alien world that is our home planet. And it has been for 400 million years, this organism. 400 stinking million years. And we come along in a million years, and what do we do to it? We trash it. We burned it until 1960. We thought, fungus, evil, witches, bad. Go away. All fungus, bad. And they burned it and killed it. And in 1960, Dr. James Trappe and several others discovered that, whoa, wait a minute. We think we found symbiosis. And the most beautiful symbiosis you could imagine. I mean, it up to 80% of the tree's photosynthetic energy goes to the organism. It feeds the organism that way, and that allows it, and it gives it sugars to produce its fruiting bodies of mushrooms above ground and truffles below ground. And in return, the tree gets absolute protection from all pathogens in the forest, gets 100% more water, gets many more roots. The first thing this thing does when it infects itself to a tree is it promotes feeder root growth. It promotes that so that there's much more surface area available for the tree to feed. It stimulates that thing in it. And then it coats it with a gelatinous-like substance, which is apart from the fibers, the filament in the ground. On the roots, it looks like you've put on a gooey rubber glove. And this is ectomycorrhizae. There's also endomycorrhizae, which invades the root and grows inside. So there's two different kinds of mycorrhizae. All ectomycorrhizae are absolutely beneficial. There are some endomycorrhizae that take a little bit more than they're giving. Okay, they're a little bit cheating. But they're still symbiotic, but they're hedging their bets, yeah? They're taking a little bit more. But all the ectos, like the Rhizopogon truncatus, the Rhizopogon vinicolor, there's 535 of them. They're all straight and narrow. Man, they're just, you give us this much, we give you that much. And it's just a cool thing. It's a true symbiosis. And we tried to kill it until 1960. That was only 43 years ago. Oh God, they'd rip it out of the ground with backhoes and harrows and burn it get rid of it. Because the tree managers of the time said, you know, all fungus is bad. And even as late as in the 90s, I would have to go deal with silviculturists who had no clue, who had not read any of the literature that had been sent them. And they say things like, we've been doing this for 50 years, boy. and I'm telling me, you've been doing it wrong, dude. I had a great time. I had a great time straightening out a lot of people. Engineers, silviculturists, I love them. They are all my good friends. They understand I meant good, you know, but they had to know. I'd take them and show them, man. We had our test plots in, fantastic. Good science proving good things. And we got them to change. But only in certain forests. Like the Siskiyou is good, but there's still a lot of forests out there that don't even listen to what they're hearing. It's just astounding. Think you're working a bureaucracy. Okay, at the epicenter of this is the Siskiyou National Forest. Okay, they're accepting this. And they have to, because the chief mycologist, Dr. Amaranthus, is right there. He's conducting all these studies. And even though the Siskiyou is affected, like the Five Rivers and the Umpqua right next to us, business as usual. It'll take years for this to happen. Even though it's right there in living green, it's going to take so long for it to work through the system.
Wait, so you're saying that today, right now, there are places that are in the United States that are still ripping out the mycorrhizae with backhoes and burning the area before they replant?
No. Contraire. I hope not they don't do that, but what they're not doing is inoculating the trees in a nursery setting. They plant, like the Stone Nursery in Central Point, Oregon, has grown billions of trees. That's what they do. They're tree farms for outplanting. And that's how we got our first break, was inoculating some of the trees in the Stone Nursery that just had phenomenal survival rate and growth rate, and it just blew them away. And that's how mycorrhizal applications got started, just because we could see the effects, and they could see the managers could see the effects, and they can't just turn around and go, oh, that isn't really good, that's great, you know, God, look at that. And then so you outplant them inoculated with the proper mycorrhizae, and then their survival rate is much higher. But this is not a practice that's going on across the United States. It's going to have to filter through the bureaucracy. And I don't know how long that takes. It's like force feeding an elk. It's going to take a while, but we'll get it there.
And so what type of survival rate changes were you experiencing?
Oh, from 37 before to 40 to 80 to 90, double. The lifespan of a Doug fir can be 700-800 years, maybe more. And during its lifespan, it'll be visited by four different kinds of mycorrhizae. One mycorrhizae for the first part of its life, Rhizopogon vinicolor is what it prefers. And 70-80 years later, another mycorrhizae just comes and replaces it totally. Whole another species. And it's maybe 200 years, okay? And then time to change. We don't understand the mechanisms by which this thing works. And then another one comes for another 300 years, and another one comes for the end of its life. What's going on there? And this is the kind of questions I'd ask the kids in school. I'd say, look at this, we got something here that we can't even fathom. We got questions, man. You gotta find answers. Your little brains are gonna find it for us. You're the dudes. And
what's that website?
It's www.mycorrhizae.com.
And how do you spell mycorrhizae?
mycorrhizae.
Give me that one more time.
mycorrhizae. And that's literally means fungus root. It means fungus root. Micro is fungus. And rhiza is root. I'd say, I got to give you a bunch of words you never heard before. I'm going to give you some Latin words like the rhizopogon and stuff, because no one's ever made these common words. There is no other way to describe what we're trying to talk about, because there are no common names for them, except for like a Picolithus tinctorius, if we're talking about a particular thing, is dead man's foot.
Why is that? Why is there no common name for mycorrhizae yet?
Oh, it's basically because, and this is a direct quote from David Aurora, that we are a fungophobic people. We come from the English stock, and the English associated truly mushrooms and toadstools and things with witches and evil and death. Not like their continental brothers who dug truffles and enjoyed mushrooms. The English were totally fungophobic, and that is passed on to us through our heritage. It's almost, I don't know if you call it genetic, but it's in there. And you have to overcome, you know, you're going to go pick wild mushrooms? Why, you could die! I mean, you know, and that's the attitude. Whereas a young Italian or French boy, when they're close to the ground, they know exactly which ones are good to eat, and they go collect food, and they get that good primal thing that I was talking about earlier. You bring home a big pail of mushrooms to mama, and she's cooking the sauce for tonight. She looks at you and she goes, "Man, you did good, dude." And so it's a familial bond. It's a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. And the children are the best mushroom collectors in the world. They see everything. God, they see everything. They are right there. You go, what's that? You know, you're looking around with your adult eyes that are, you know, you filtered out almost everything to get here. I just want to see young children just jump in this thing. That was my goal when I found where I was at, because I was working with brilliant doctors, God, and they'd let me they'd come up with their experiments, but I get to lay them out, you know. I was the field guy, and I just loved doing it, because I just go, God, that's a good thing to ask, you know, and this is a cool way to answer it, and I would appreciate what they're doing. But then I got to actually go out there and build in the field these test sites, and that's because I'm a hands-on kind of guy. I like to touch what I'm doing, you know. Every mushroom, every truffle, very exciting to me.
Yeah, I wanted to ask that. Did you bring mycorrhizae samples to the kids and let them play with it? Did they get to have it in their science class as part of the project?
I'd have a whole collection of mushrooms for them to examine, and bring in the deadly ones. And there's a really cool way to identify any deadly mushrooms. There are a lot of ones that are called LBMs, little brown mushrooms. There's a lot of those, and they're rust colored. kind of brownish, those are all make you sick. They won't kill you. The ones that kill you, and you should absolutely avoid, are the ones that have a cup at the bottom of the stem. So you dig up the entire mushroom carefully, and if there's a bowl or a cup around the base of the stem, every deadly, horrible mushroom grows like that. There are one or two, it's an Italian favorite, but even Italians die because they mistake it for something else. If it grows out of a cup, don't pick it up. Leave it there. There's just one or two. Caesar's ammonitis. It's a delicious mushroom, and it grows out of a cup, and it is safe to eat. But the son of I think Robert Mondavi in the winery up north. He's Italian. He's been picking mushrooms all his life, and 5 or 6 years ago he thought he had Caesar's ammonitis. He didn't. He's dead. So even an experienced picker since childhood can make a mistake, and it's just not worth it. If it grows out of a cup, leave it alone. The others will merely make you sick. These will eat your liver, and you'll get violently sick after 24 hours, and you will stay sick for 24 hours. You'll puke, you'll diarrhea, you'll nausea, you'll chill, you'll fever, and then after 24 hours you get better. You feel fine. It's great. And then 24 hours later it comes back and kills you. And no one's ever done anything else but that without a total liver transplant. It's a horrible death. When you get better, you know you got one more moonside, one more sunset, that's it, you're done. Whoa. Bye-bye. But if it grows out of a cup, just don't pick it up. You know? And I have been offered Caesar's ammonitis and refused it. Because I'm not sure who picked it. You know, I didn't see it cooked. I don't know what it is now. I just go, no. And it's supposed to be the best. But I'm just terrified of it because of the... That's just a nasty way to die, man. On the contrary, there are all these truffles that are associated with the every mushroom above ground. There's a corresponding truffle below ground. And what we do is collect the truffles, mix them in solution, and that's how we inoculate trees in a nursery setting. And two of these truffles are edible of the 535. Only Tuberous gerbosum and Tuberous californium are edible, and they're quite delicious. They're very garlicky and earthy, and they bring the flavor out of food like you wouldn't believe. Just simple pasta and butter, Tuberous gerbosum, and it just, you go, just the nicest pasta I ever had.
I want to know how the pigs find this special truffle. What is it with the pigs?
Because it puts off a sexual smell. It puts off a sexual hormone, which most resembles a pig in rut. And all the other junk, all the other forest animals respond to this. It uses sex to attract, it wants to be eaten and have its spores spread. The flying squirrel and the voles are the primary eaters of these. And what eats those are the spotted owls. Spotted owls only eat truffles stuffed mammals. And then they fly across and their scat puts the mycorrhizae further and further afield. It's a very intelligent way to spread its spores. So this organism communicates directly with the vegetable planet or vegetable world, and it's in the fungal kingdom. It's its own kingdom now. It wasn't 10 years ago. They couldn't decide what to do with fungus, and they finally went, it's its own kingdom. So it's five kingdoms, and the fungal kingdom is its own thing, and it directly communicates in an embracing way with the vegetable kingdom, and then turns around and talks to mammals to spread itself. If this isn't intelligence, what is? We're not talking to nobody else but ourselves. That's all we can talk to, and we're just blathering. This thing's making things grow. True?
It's absolutely true.
This is what I call intelligence. We're just simians, just off the trees, and we think we're cool. This planet's here. Look how cool it is. Something's been doing this. I'm so humbled by it. I am. And I think the whole planet should be humble. There should be a humble day. We want a humble day on planet Earth where we revere the Earth. We say, Mama, we're so sorry. We're doing what we're doing to you. We'll get better. And then maybe we'll get better if we all think about it. And for my children. My children are growing up in this wackiness. And they're the loveliest things on the planet.
I'm Scott Fratcher, and you're listening to a program about mycorrhizae and mycorrhizae research. This program was produced by Scott Fratcher and Allison Thompson. Both were students of Radio for Peace International and graduates of the Institute for Progressive Communications. Radio for Peace is a listener-sponsored progressive shortwave station broadcasting from El Rodeo, Costa Rica. Radio for Peace does not accept corporate sponsorship. Radio for Peace needs your help. Log on to rfpi.org. That's rfpi.org to see how you can help or support Radio for Peace International.
Up in Brighton Bush, every October they have a mycorrhizal conference. Brighton Bush is on the Detroit River, just east of Salem, and there will be several hundred crazies, and Ken Kesey would be amongst them before he died. And Dr. Amaranthus, Dr. Trappie, Dr. Nick Malachak from Australia, just wonderful people. Top three leading experts on psilocybin mushrooms. And this is a serious mycorrhizal conference. And this man got up and said, first words were, I'm here to tell you that psilocybin mushrooms are a force for good on this planet. Then he went through to tell you how through shamanistic use, it inspired us to language and to our consciousness that we now enjoy. Sped along our evolution, because 50,000 years ago, all of a sudden we just popped. We just went bluey. I mean, we were just, you know, we were grunting along fine, and we would have grunted along fine for another 200,000, but something happened 50,000 years ago that just, bam, it was, and he postulates that it was the use, the shamanistic use in the original form of psilocybin mushrooms and other psychedelic substances, but mainly psilocybin mushrooms, because they're very common. These guys were great. I mean, you're dealing with open minds. It's so nice to deal without the filter of some regulatory agency, you know, just to be able to speak mind to mind. And that example there to me is speaking mind to mind. I love these people, and I could deal openly and freely with them, and there's no censor, no nothing, just you know. You gotta love that.
And how long did you work in the mycorrhizae field?
12 years. Oh, that wasn't long enough.
Hey, you told me one time that you saw some tree planters going on an area that had been destroyed by a bulldozer.
Oh, no name slide.
No name slide.
No name slide. There's a Jippo logger came in and ran a bulldozer right down the hill for an access road, right across a creek, and just scraped everything to bare nothing, and no topsoil left. And then skipped on his $10,000 bond because he made $250 on the Jippo trees he sold. He didn't care about the 10 grand. Okay, paid a fine. Oh, darn. Cost of business. And so the Forest Service wanted to replant the scarification. It was just ugly. Right across the creek, Scott. Beautiful. And up above it is a place called No Name Slide, which will come back later in our story. And so... I'm out there setting up these mycorrhizal field tests, where some of the plots have just pure water, some of them have mycorrhizae of different concentrations, and I forgot there was four different plots, but we're setting them up to study the growth rate to see what happens. This is early in the understanding what we're dealing with. Even though we just discovered it in 1960, doesn't mean we made any progress until 1980, 1990. We were still in the dark. It was all study until then. Practical applications only came in the 90s. Very amazing.
Less than 10 years ago, application of mycorrhizae started.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so go on.
It was just unheard of. Nobody knows what you're talking about. Here's the most amazing organism planet. And it's just like, it's underground and it's hard to study. A whole community of activists have been turned on to mycorrhizae. It's just the people that are doing the work. I'll give a boost to Weyerhaeuser, okay? Weyerhaeuser, in its wisdom, because it realized it could make a profit, I'm sure, one of the first big orders for mycorrhizal application was $450,000 worth of spores just for field testing.
That's a big investment.
That's a planet.
This is just when Dr. Amarantha started the company. He started with $60,000 of seed money and hard workers around him. And then it started taking off, and now he's getting orders from countries. I mean, multi-million dollar orders from countries. You know, India, China has completely depleted the mycorrhizae. There's nothing left. They're having to bring in boatloads of dirt and mycorrhizae from Australia in these special forests where if you get caught in there, they'll shoot you. And it's a federal, you can get killed going in one of these special forests in China because they realize finally that they are the worst rapers of the land on the planet, but they've been at it 5,000 years. It's hard not to be. But the mycorrhizae will allow plant life to reestablish itself on the Asian continent. It is truly a worldwide thing because this mycorrhizae, 95% of all plant life on this planet is mycorrhizal. If it's in place, everything grows and it takes care of each other. And then we get to thrive off that juice. That's our movie. Almost everything is mycorrhizal.
It's almost like the underground oxygen. The underground good. Source of oxygen. It's like
good.
It's like the supply of oxygen
that.
To the roots of.
Thank you, Allison.
Of the plants that
That's
are
a
the lungs
beautiful
of the
analogy.
Planet that provide us with air to breathe.
Yeah. And in just such a gorgeously humble way it does it, and it's been doing it. The oldest fossil records either date to 400 or 450 million years of Picolithus tinctorius, the dead man's foot I showed you. I don't know if I showed you. It's the most primitive spore on the planet, fossilized 400 plus million years ago. It ain't changed a bit. Keeps doing the same thing it does. You put it on a cedar tree, that cedar tree, instead of growing a foot and a half in 3 years, will be up to 18 feet in 3 years.
Really?
Yes. Oh, it's amazing. It's putting all the pieces of nature together and saying, go at them, guys, work, have a good time. Instead of separating nature, remember this number, 95% of all plant life, I mean, it's all plant life, is mycorrhizal. It gets at 100% more water automatically.
Can you retrofit a tree? You know, can you like go
yes.
back?
Oh, yeah. Inoculate. All you have to do is find the drip line, and before it rains, you spread the mycorrhizal spores around the drip line, that big circle. As it rains, the spores will go down in, and it will infect the tree. It is absolutely retroactive. This stuff is amazing. I'm like Tom Robbins. I believe that it floated here. Doesn't need nothing. It's totally self-contained. It'll come alive when it hits moist earth and water. It could come from anywhere. I mean, we live in a very large universe. It could come from anywhere. And I hope you do see that seriously because
absolutely.
It is a very, it's, oh, over the life of our planet, how many things have come here?
From spore.
or whatever, you know, we don't know.
Okay, so you were telling me about No Name Slide. You came along and
okay.
these guys made this cut in the mountainside.
Okay, so the Forest Service workers are coming by and I'm setting up my experiment. And first day they're planting trees. And they plant all these little Doug fir trees from the stone nursery. And they're all from the same batch, every. And they plant up to the creek, and a little bit past. And the next day they come by at 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm whipping up my vat, my witch's brew of mycorrhizae to dip our trees in. And I saw the crew walking by, and I called them over. I said, "Come on over, guys, and dip your trees in here." And, "Oh, we already dipped them in water." I said, "Well, this is special water. Please humor me." And they all came over and took their trees out of their tree bags. You wear about 50 trees on each side of your hips. I don't know if you've ever seen them. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
No, what do they look like?
Oh, they're these big collapsible pouches that go on a belt and a strap around your shoulders, and they hold approximately 50 seedlings in each side, and you carry a planting tool that's just, it's an awl-like tool that just goes in the ground, it's pointed, and it comes up broad. You slap it in and pull back, and it makes a nice little wide space. And you slip the tree down in to the bottom, and then slightly pull up on it so the roots are all pointed down.
Uh-huh.
And fill in a hole and move on to the next tree. It's a very quick process. People work.
And how far apart are they planting these trees?
They plant 10 to 12 feet. You work off there's a lead man, and everybody works off of him as you go up a hill or across whatever you're doing. And you space yourself, and you go through.
About how long does it take to plant the 50 trees?
Oh, less than an hour. They've got 100 trees, 50 in each side. And then you go refill and take water and stuff. Anyway, so these guys dipped their trees in my solution and went off planting. And I did I conducted Dr. Amaranthus's experiment for the next 2-3 years, and found great results. And then I was also farmed out to the soils lab at the Siskiyou National Forest. I did soils work, and they wanted me to go up and put in some permanent photo points for no-name slides, so we could monitor the movement over years. So you have to do these compass points, and you set them up with rebar and it's not survey equipment. You just set up stuff that you know that you can get the same shot in 2 or 3 years. And so I was going up there to do that, and I did that. It was fun. But on the way up, I'm walking through. The easiest way up is through the Jip O' Loggers old road. It's the smoothest way. So I'm walking through these little trees, and when they come out of the nursery, they're like, oh, this big, oh, like a foot. And then all these trees that I'm walking through are, 14, 16, maybe 18 inches. Okay, and they're looking pretty good. They're green. Not too many deaths, and I'm going, that's good, because there's no soil. I mean, soil's gone. They're just planting them in rocks. It's just horrible. Then I come to the point where they dipped them, and there wasn't a tree, not only not dead, but every tree was 4 feet high and blue-green, and you couldn't see through it. This was with Rhizopogon finicolor. You couldn't see through the tree. It was just like a little Christmas tree. And you look back, and you went, same tree? Same tree? Same tree? It can't be same tree. Same tree. Man, I went back to the office that night, and I drug a whole bunch of people out there. I said, look at this. Look at this. You don't believe our experiments? Look at this. And a whole bunch of converts came about then. They went, from a forest ranger down. I drug everybody out there. I went, you guys got to look at this. This is serious. This is a big deal. I'm excited. You're getting me here. And then through that and other experiments, I don't think mycorrhizal applications is even 4 or 5 years old. They just started.
Really?
And he's the premier mycorrhizal spore dealer in the world. He has no known competitor, because the Pacific Northwest, number one, has 535 species, maybe more now. Europe has 8. Acid rain has killed them. So there's a crisis on the planet, but it's underground. And as long as we're killing people above ground, we're certainly not going to notice anything like that, are we?
The mycorrhizae, do they do anything for pollution?
Oh, it's affected by pollution. Yeah, acid rain kills it. And there have, Dr. Amaranthus has tried to get several atmospheric studies underway, but they were never funded because we wanted to answer that question.
I wonder if drinking the rain here, if it isn't acid rain or...
I would think not. Eastern Europe and Central Europe are horribly affected.
On the United States?
East coast of the United States is horribly affected.
But the Sismis is too narrow to be affected by acid rain?
Well, the Pacific coast has got that nice onshore breeze. And most of, we have 535 mycorrhizal types. 8 in Europe. Think about it.
What about down here?
People from Europe, doctors from Europe come to the Siskiyou and to the West Coast, and they are just astounded at the variety and also the messiness of our forest, because in Europe, especially in Germany, they're tree farms, and they pick up any twig that's bigger than your little finger, and they stack it neatly, and they take it off for firewood and stuff. So these are just like, they're like parks. And then in our forest, in the Pacific Northwest, there's giant logs laying here. And there's all kinds. Their favorite word was, your forests are so messy. 95%, that's a huge number. That means coconut trees, that means everything.
Explain what you mean by it's mycorrhizal.
It is adapted to accept mycorrhizae. It has gone through a history of mycorrhizae being on its roots and living with it in a symbiotic way.
So what would be the 5% that is not mycorrhizae?
Oh, they're like they're weird things like oleanders. And, you know, there's just a few. It's really a startlingly small number of organisms that don't use mycorrhizae. Some grasses don't. Some grasses do. It's.
What about wheat?
Wheat. No, wheat is mycorrhizae. So are grapes. God, man, the list is endless. 95%. Think about it. It's just a few little things to do. Yeah, we'll put them over here in this corner, and we'll talk about them later. Let's work on a big problem here. It's just a matter of how much of the stuff you can produce and get to the countries, and whether it's going to be used properly, and how many decades it will take for the change to happen. When you consider that in 1960 we discovered it, in 1990 we were just finding out how to use it, in the late 90s they were really starting to apply it. I mean, there's a 40-year gap right there between discovery and actual use, and how long will it take before it really gets out there? And then there's all the time it takes a tree to grow. So we're looking hundreds of years down the road.
And how is mycorrhizae produced?
Oh, it's produced by, it's the fruiting body of the mycorrhizae. It's above ground it's a mushroom, and below ground is a truffle. The truffle is an evolutionary advancement over a mushroom, and is that a mushroom has to grow a stalk and a cap and gills, and then its spores are spread by the wind. Truffle below ground is total spores, a billion spores in the size of my thumb, and it gets eaten by a rodent, or the rodent gets eaten by an owl, and the spores spread that way, and it's a very efficient way to use your energy. And that's the direction that mushrooms are going. They're going toward truffles. We have that when you cut it open, you can see inside the form of a mushroom. It is a transitional truffle that is going toward, it's evolving. You can actually watch this happening right in front of you. It's evolving toward a truffle. And you go, dang, it's one of them things, man. Because it's given up. It's gone, this is the way to go. I get more spores per dollar, yeah, out
so,
there.
But how are you collecting spores commercially then?
You dig the truffles up.
How does it take to make a 5-gallon bucket of mycorrhizae that I could pack on a system of transport and bring it to Panama and
They dry it and send it to you in packages. You add water, put it on your stuff.
So if a farmer here in Panama wanted to
make his corn grow huge,
wanted to nourish the earth with mycorrhizae, what would he do?
He'd get a hold of mycorrhizal applications. And they will either send them through their subsidiary roots, or they will deal with him directly, and they're just extraordinary people. It's Michael and his wife Eileen, and their five wonderful children, and it's just a family run business. And he's just brilliant. He's one of the most articulate and dedicated people I've ever met in the field.
Okay,
besides Dr. Jim Trappi.
But if you go back and say the truffles are produced.
Yeah. Okay, they're the fruiting body.
Okay, they're the fruiting body. But then what's the process that the person actually uses? They dig up the truffles and then...
To get a 5-gallon bucket full of mycorrhizae.
Oh, you can either go through mycorrhizal applications, or say you find a truffle.
Uh-huh.
Well, number one, you'd have to identify it.
Okay. So you got identified.
Okay, you got over 500 kinds. So that's why you need somebody like mycorrhizal applications. You don't know what this applies to. He does. He knows every truffle and what plant it applies to.
Okay, so nobody's going to do this at home. I just want to know the process because it's really interesting to me.
Oh, the process has been inoculating every known species with mycorrhizae and finding out which ones work. It's just trial and error. It's been an incredible amount of work, Scott. I mean, it's mind-boggling when you think about it. God, you go, some of them you can guess because they're growing underneath a certain tree. And so you go, okay, this is for that tree. But what else is it for? Is it applicable to da-da-da and da-da-da? You don't know. So you've got a basic question answered by where you collected the truffle.
Okay, and how many truffles would be under in like a square foot of ground patch, for example?
Well, mycorrhizae grows in a big circle, as all underground funguses. They grow in circles. And the outward edge of them is what produces the fruiting body, generally. And what you do is you look for squirrel digs and vole digs that aren't holes. They're not making a burrow. They're looking for food. And you take a little fork, a little truffle fork, 4-inch long, prawns, tines, 4 of them, and you gently dig down. And if he might have been looking for insects too, you don't know. But generally, they only eat the ripest truffles. And so you dig down and you go, oh yeah, here's a little nest of 6 or 8. Okay. And you go around the tree and you go, you know, nothing else there. You go to the next tree, check it out. And in just a matter of a few hours, you might have 2 pounds of truffles. Well, that's enough to inoculate 400,000 trees.
400,000?
Oh yeah.
Okay, so now you have truffles. How do you inoculate trees with truffles?
You separate the you take the truffle, you break it down, and it's each spore has got a sporocarp around it, a little covering.
Uh-huh.
So each one of this, remember, there's a billion of them in the end of my thumb.
Okay.
And each spore has a sporocarp, and you have to break that off. Well, there's a mechanical way and a chemical way to break it off. And now you're left with just pure spores, which you dry, you package, and you label, and you say, this is for these different kinds of plants. You send them off and with instructions on how much to put in and how much water and how to do it. It's so simple a fourth grader could do it. It's just a matter of getting the product, and no one's been looking. And we spent, years just combing the world. We'd go to Australia, New Zealand, New Guinea.
Does a person have to know the name and the genus of the plant that they want to inoculate then in order to order the proper mycorrhizae?
Yeah. Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah.
So
oh, definitely.
In a jungle patch, say, you know, you buy this, you know, acre of land, and you need to assess what is growing.
Well, there are certain basic primitive mycorrhizae like Picolithus tinctoris that are just custom made for a variety of stuff. Mm-hmm. They'll attach to almost anything, but there are some things that want an endomycorrhizae, and it is beyond my comprehension, the complexity of it all.
Thank you, David, for being on the program. And now we move to Dr. Amarathis. I'm Scott Fratcher, and you're listening to a program about mycorrhizae and mycorrhizae research. This program was produced by Scott Fratcher and Allison Thompson. Both were students of Radio for Peace International and graduates of the Institute for Progressive Communications. Radio for Peace is a listener-sponsored progressive shortwave station broadcasting from El Rodeo, Costa Rica. Radio for Peace does not accept corporate sponsorship. Radio for Peace needs your help. Log on to rfpi.org, that's rfpi.org, to see how you can help or support Radio for Peace International. Dr. Amarathis, welcome to the program. Can you talk a little bit about the resource distribution between undisturbed areas of the environment and cultured areas of the environment?
You don't need to fertilize as heavily. You don't need to irrigate. And that's why these natural areas survive and even thrive without inputs of water, fertilizer, and pesticides, because everything is conserved and recycled. It's the man-made environments where much of that material is wasted because the root systems are not near as elaborate as they are in these mycorrhizal systems, and nitrogen, you know, leaches into groundwater, and water runs off, and you get erosion losses and phosphorus losses, and all those losses cause impacts to other parts of the ecosystem.
I understand that clear cutting, that once an area has been clear cut, that then the UV is able to enter the what would have been protected by the canopy, and that kills the mycorrhizae, is that correct?
Well, what happens in a clear cutting situation, the mycorrhizae depend upon the plants for the energy that they need to survive and grow. And especially in a very large opening, you've removed the energy, the pumps of energy that the mycorrhizae depend on. So they're lost. And how long they're lost because they don't have any, they can't decompose organic matter. They rely on the plants for their carbohydrate needs. So what happens is a lot of the mycorrhizae will die over time. Depending on how rapidly these areas revegetate and how close the surrounding natural areas are, they can reinvade an area. But some of the mycorrhizae don't move around in the wind, and so they're very slow to recolonize an area once they've been lost. So, I mean, we've worked on some places that 30 years later, the mycorrhizae haven't come back. But in some cases, with, like, thinning operations, you know, generally you don't lose the mycorrhizal population.
I understand there's over 500 different types of mycorrhizae, and that we know what about 150 of them do. Is that correct?
Well, there's for the endomycorrhizae, which are by far the most common, they form with almost 500,000 plant species. There are really only 150 that are described on the planet, and there may be more than that. And a lot of these groups, you know, are important for phosphorus, nutrient uptake and for water uptake and protection against diseases and drought, etc. So a lot of them do different things. So that's for the endomycorrhiza. For the conifers and oaks, there's a lot more mycorrhizal diversity. There's probably between 4,000 and 5,000 of those. But for the more common plants, there are just, you know, probably 150 that have been described to date. And I really don't have any concept of how many may be out there that we haven't described.
What type of survival changes do you find with mycorrhizae applications compared to standard planting procedures?
Well, we just published a study in this month's Journal of Arboriculture where we did an outplanting study with pine trees, and we did it in some pretty harsh environments, and we went from about 37% survival to over 90% survival, and the only difference is that we added mycorrhizae to the seedlings as we were growing them. So they just transplanted much better having the mycorrhizae on the roots. And that just got published this month in the Journal of Arboriculture. And we've done, I mean, there's probably several hundred studies. I mean, that's one that we just published. But if you look at survival rates and outplanting studies, there's probably several hundred studies. And the vast majority of them show a pretty positive response in terms of survival.
And why do you think it is that mycorrhizae is still such an unknown science in the world?
Well, I think it's the fault of us scientists. I mean, we did a terrible job. You know, there's 50,000 studies on mycorrhizae, and even the ones that I've written are so full of jargon and scientific terminology that they're basically incomprehensible to a common person. And, you know, in the scientific literature, basically the mycorrhizal scientists have been spending a couple decades just talking to each other. We really haven't reached out into the general audience that would benefit from this information, agriculture, forestry, etc. So it's been a communication problem primarily. And it's a couple other issues. One is that people are generally afraid of fungi. So there's this natural aversion to fungi, as, you know, we think of moldy bread and itchy toes. That it's a real negative thing. So, you know, part of it's cultural. And part of it has been the inability of the scientists to communicate the idea in a very, you know, easy to understand way.
I like that about the jargon, which is a good portion of why we're doing this program, actually. They say that there are the mushroom picking that's going on in the Pacific Northwest. I've heard that that's a $400 million a year industry now. And some people say that that the mushroom picking is actually exceeding the timber industry in revenues. And yet the timber industry that continues the clear cutting and such is in part destroying the mushroom industry. Do you have any comment on that?
Well, I think that the mushroom industry is a significant source of income for people, especially for certain kinds of groups of people. I mean, it's an important revenue source for, you know, many groups, and it can be, you know, recreationally important in certain areas where a lot of recreational pickers come. So beyond just the price of the mushroom, got people that are areas recreationally, and that adds to the economy as well. And clear cutting does, you know, destroy those areas in terms of their harvest potential, at least for some period of time until those areas revegetate. And in some cases, it can be several decades. It's an important value that often isn't considered when people think of timber values. So there are some things you can do. For example, some mushroom species actually prefer thinned environments. So in some cases, silvicultural practices like thinning trees can actually enhance the mushroom production. So this is an area that there really needs to be more, not only more research, but also more application of that research, you know, on a scale that's appropriate for forestry.
Since mycorrhizae, it was discovered in 1960, is that correct?
Well, the mycorrhiza was first described back in 1880s. So the term has been around for some time. It wasn't into, you know, the 1920s, 1930s that they were appreciated as being beneficial. And it wasn't until the 1960s that research became, you know, elaborate enough to really understand what these things are doing. So they were around, people have seen them and described them for over 100 years. But research really began in earnest in 1960.
And has any research been done on how genetically engineered crops do with mycorrhiza or any of that?
Not that I've seen. I know that some plants have been bred to not depend on mycorrhiza. So there are some genetically, I don't know if they're genetically modified or just been selected for their ability to do well without mycorrhizae, because many of these agricultural environments have lost their mycorrhiza, and the plants that do best are the ones that have less dependence upon the mycorrhiza. So I know, like, for example, some of the corn varieties are less likely to form mycorrhizae than the wild cultivars.
How old is mycorrhiza?
460 million years old. It's probably nature's most successful experiment. And if you look at the earliest fossil records of the roots of plants, the earliest land plants, about 460 million years ago, they contain mycorrhiza. And the fact that we don't have any land plants that didn't have mycorrhiza has led the scientific community to believe that it was the fortuitous marriage of aquatic plants with these primitive fungi, which allowed them to leave their aquatic environment, colonize a relatively harsh earth surface. So there really were no land plants before they were mycorrhiza. It was the mycorrhiza that allowed these plants to colonize their surface. It's that fundamental.
What effect do pesticides have on mycorrhiza?
Well, some fungicides eliminate them. The more broad spectrum, you know, these soil sterilants, you know, they kill the soil diseases, but they also kill the mycorrhiza. But there are many fungicides now, especially some of the newer ones, that the mycorrhiza can tolerate. So it really depends on the type of pesticide.
With mycorrhiza applications, does that decrease the need for pesticides?
Well, what we do is we try and work with customers to help them change to using fungicides that do not impact the mycorrhiza. Many of these clients, once the mycorrhiza form, they don't need the pesticides because the mycorrhiza will control the disease organism. So a lot of the people can eliminate their use of fungicides or alter their use of fungicides to less toxic varieties. If people want a list of the fungicides and pesticides that affect mycorrhiza, our website is www.mycorrhizae.com. That's mycorrhizae.com. And if you go to that website, there's a bunch of informative articles on mycorrhiza and their uses, including that list of fungicides and their effects on mycorrhiza.
You say mycorrhiza and mycorrhizae. Is there a difference between the two?
Yeah, the mycorrhiza is singular and the mycorrhizae is plural.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Amaranthus.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Have a good day now.
All right. Bye.
You've been listening to Radio for Peace International, and this was a show on mycorrhizae featuring mycorrhizae researcher David Arthur and Dr. Michael Amaranthus. I'm Scott Fratcher.
And I'm Allison Thompson, and you've been listening to Radio for Peace International.
For more information about Radio for Peace International or the Institute for Progressive Communication, log on to rfpi.org.